welcome into the All Ball Podcast. Your boy Doug Gottlieb here. Make sure you follow me on Twitter, at Gottlieb Show. If you're watching on Instagram, on IG Live, at Gottlieb Show as well. And, of course, you can follow my Facebook page. We'll put this out as well. We got two great guests on the podcast. Tim Livingston, who did a podcast which they had Tim Donaghy on. We'll have Tim Donaghy on eventually. But we talked about Donaghy, some of the allegations that he made about the NBA. And I think you'll find it fascinating, the connection between that era of the league and the current era of the league. And one official who, ironically, used to have a bunch of phone calls with Tim Donaghy, still officiating at a very high level in the NBA. Any cause for concern, any, we'll get down to it. Also, Marvin Menzie, who, of course, has been the head coach of New Mexico State. He's actually coach of the century in the WAC, will join us. Wait to hear his stories. Okay, do you know he owned a bakery? I didn't. Did you know that he ran a nightclub? I did know that one. There's a bunch of other hijinks I think you'll love. Marvelous Marvin Menzie. If you're a West Coast guy, an LA guy, Santa Monica City College, San Diego State, Sac State, forgot about them, UNLV, USC, Louisville, New Mexico State, then back to UNLV, now at Grand Canyon. So a lot to get to with him. Let me quickly give you one thought on the Boston Celtics. Then I'll give you one thought on why LeBron James should have been the NBA's MVP. First on the Celtics. I understand it sounds like infighting and Marcus Smart cursing at his dudes and stuff being thrown around the locker room. But guess what? I own a dog. Do you own a dog? If you own a dog, you know the dogs occasionally will growl at one another, and sometimes they'll snap at one another. It doesn't mean that they're going to go full-on dogfight or that you need to gather around and put some money down on old Buffy, who's a sheep-a-doodle, right? No. Dogs will fight, growl, snap, as they kind of, in the pecking order of any pack animal, one has to take the lead. And if not, there'll be some snapping, there'll be some barking, there'll be some biting. That's what you have with the Celtics. Look, any team that's any good that's ever been on, you lose, you're pissed, especially when you have a lead late in the game. Now, for me, I do think this is a big challenge for Brad Stevens, who's seen as a basketball genius, and I agree with that. I think he's a marvelous coach. But can you take a hold of these massive personalities? And maybe more importantly, can all that great offense, can you run it late, especially when they go to a zone, as you saw the Miami Heat did? Big challenge for the Celtics. So anyway, in summation with the Boston Celtics, look, is it problematic that they couldn't score against the zone, that they had a lead late, and they took some bad shots, and they couldn't get? Yes. But little dudes getting after it in the locker room, getting pissed that you lose, I do consider the alternative, which is what if guys aren't upset and throwing things when they lose a game they feel like they should rightfully win? Obviously, you got to win game three. If you win game three, we got ourselves a series because anything is possible. They very easily could have won game one and game two. Think about, though, the Celtics have not bounced back from trauma well. They were up 3-0, and that series was about to be over in their previous series. If not for a miracle three by the Toronto Raptors. And they would have been up 1-0 if not for Bam Adebayo's amazing block. And, of course, then they turn around and lose game two. I think it's a series. I think it probably goes seven. But they got to win three if we even want to have four be a question. Now, Giannis is the MVP. And I understand it. And I respect it. And he's a great player. And he didn't play that many minutes. And they won more games than anybody. And stats are great. But then this is not taking the playoffs or the bubble. I'm just telling you this. Value to a team is not just assists. It's not just stats. It's, if I told you this story, LeBron James, who I do place some of the responsibility for the dysfunction within the Lakers on him last year. But from last year, the end of the season, we have forgotten what a mess they were. He came back and they lost to teams that were tanking. Then Magic Johnson quit before the last game. No exit interviews. They fire Luke Walton. Well, first they didn't fire him, then they did fire him. Then they were going to hire Ty Lue, but Ty Lue balked at only a 3-year deal. They hire Frank Vogel, and it was like, right? Hire Frank Vogel. And then they hire Jason Kidd as assistant, and people are like, well, Jason Kidd's going to take the job. They're the best defensive team in the West. LeBron's not their best defender, but his leadership is why. He led the league in assists in order to get Anthony Davis going. And look, you can tell me that the roster's good. I will tell you that Danny Green is washed up. Kyle Kuzma's had a bad year. Rondo is really over the hill, and he's been banged up much of the year. They didn't get Darren Collison. I mean, go through that roster, and outside of Anthony Davis, who's playing out of his mind because LeBron is getting him the ball and talking him up. They became the best defensive team in the West. They had the best record in the West. At the end of the regular part of the regular season before it got shut down, they beat the Bucks. They beat the Clippers. They were the best team. The cohesion of that team is because of their leadership. Your leadership is your best player. The best player is LeBron James. He should be the MVP. That's just me. All right, let's get you. It's a really interesting podcast out there investigating Tim Donaghy, the claims he made. Some were validated, some were not. Let's check in with Tim Livingston. Livingston, of course, hosts the Whistleblower podcast. He joins us on the All Ball podcast. Tim, what was the impetus? Why create this podcast?
The impetus was, well, I grew up, Doug, I'm going to give you a shout out real quick because I'm a Jewish point guard from Southern California.
Nice.
And you're our idol. You're what we all aspire to be, and most of us lack the athleticism to become that. But I think the impetus was I grew up playing basketball and I love basketball. I love the sports. So when this scandal happened and all this came out, it hurt me at such a deep level. It really rocked me to my core. And this investigation, which has taken place over 8 years, was kind of a healing process. I wanted to understand everything that happened, the darkest thing that's ever happened in the NBA in basketball, in my opinion. And that's where this odyssey really kind of kicked off from.
Okay. So when you approached Tim Donaghy, like, were you friend of court? Like, cause that's actually what I struggle with is like what I think he did, regardless of why he did it or how, what he exposed by doing it. It strikes at the very heart or the core of what sports is about, you know, on the opposite, you know, the opposite of what sports is, you know, supposed to be about. And I mean, it's like one of those, he's not a murderer, right? I don't think he like killed anybody, but outside of doing physical harm to another human being, it's pretty bad what he did. How do you approach even the discussion with him?
It's a really good question. So Donaghy and I originally connected in 2012. And he reached out to me. I wrote an article that said, yeah, this guy is kind of a schmuck, but I kind of believe some of the things that he's saying about the system. I watch a lot of basketball, as I'm sure you do, and I'm sure a lot of your audience does. And there were games during that era of the NBA, late 90s, early 2000s, where something didn't feel right. And so that's where our relationship started from. And over the course of this investigation and our first three episodes of the podcast, Tim Donaghy's not happy with me right now because I exposed, he's been lying about a lot of stuff for a lot of years. And we exposed a lot of that, right? We exposed that the money that he claims that he brought in during the course of the scheme, he claims that he made $30,000 in the primary season that this took place. He was fixing games over the course of 4 years. We kind of dispel that pretty soundly. We also, Donnie's also claimed that he didn't, quote, fix games. And we have a lot of evidence now that he did, and we present that accordingly. So Donaghy's not an empathetic character by any means, but what's interesting about Donaghy and the reason this is titled Whistleblower is the idea that he was blowing the proverbial whistle about something, about a larger problem within officiating in basketball. And this is focused on the NBA, but we found evidence, which we're not even going to get into in this podcast, that are permeated deeper than that, that it went into college basketball and then went into baseball, football, tennis. It's really just looking at all sports. This is an investigation into corruption at every level through the lens of, you know, we're trusting officials, we're trusting referees to police our sports. And in this instance, with Donaghy, he is obviously not a trustworthy policeman, but with a lot of other officials, in my opinion, and after listening to this podcast where, you know, we break down Michael Franzis, former mobster, says he had two NBA referees on his payroll in the early 90s. There's a lot of evidence tying Scott Foster to Tim Donaghy, and their friendship and their relationship was extremely suspicious, and nobody's ever looked into that. And Scott Foster is a top-ranked official in the NBA. So we wanted to just dive into this investigation and really start to unravel a lot of this and And I think what we found is pretty fascinating.
Okay, so what did you find?
So with Scott Foster and Tim Donaghy exchanged 134 phone calls from April 2007, during the height of the scheme. Mm-hmm. Scott Foster and Tim Donaghy always talked immediately after Tim talked to his bookie, but almost every time they talked was right after Tim talked to his bookie. The duration of their phone calls was 2 minutes long. The NBA, in its Pedowitz report, which it published right after this scandal, they claimed that Foster says they talked to kill time. Doug, I mean, first off, I haven't talked to another human being 134 times over the course of 6 months. That's not my wife ever. But if I'm calling you to kill time, I don't think we're talking for 2 minutes. Scott Foster, so Donaghy's co-conspirator, Tommy Martino, who he shared everything with, whenever Scott Foster called Tim Donaghy, he stepped outside to take those phone calls. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence around Scott Foster that nobody's ever investigated. And I don't understand why. And I don't think, personally, I just don't think until he sits down and answers some of these questions about his relationship with Tim Donaghy, that he should be reffing the NBA's most important games. Another quick detail, every call that Donaghy had several phones, he was calling Foster from the phone that he used for gambling. This was the phone that he was calling his bookie from, and only people related to the betting scheme. And that was the phone he was calling Scott Foster from. There's just a lot of questions, you know, regarding the guy who now is the most controversial referee today, 2020 in the NBA, that nobody's ever answered. And I just don't understand why.
That's fascinating. Where else in basketball is this? You know, Scott Foster obviously is a big name. Is there anybody else who's currently involved in the sport that is at least mildly suspicious?
In my opinion, not really. I think the NBA has done a really good job 13 years later. I think when you think back to that era, I can name, and again, I'm probably not the best example because I've spent so much of my life researching this, but I feel like as basketball fans, there's guys from that era, Dick Pivetta, Joey Crawford, Danny Crawford, just referees that were just reffing every game, that were part of the show, that we really knew. If you look at the NBA today, most of the referees are anonymous, which they should be. That's part of the vocation, is that you should only exist in the shadows. This is, we're tuning in to watch LeBron James and watch James Harden and watch the stars. And I think a big problem with that era was that a lot of these referees made themselves a part of the show in a really suspicious way. So I think the NBA today is in a great place. I think the game's in a great place. I think in 2006, 2007, you have to look at a lot of these games and a lot of the free throw discrepancies in the playoff games that Donaghy referenced. I mean, we've had games. There's obviously the 2002 Western Conference Finals, which is probably the most controversial game in NBA history, where the Lakers shot 27 free throws in the fourth quarter. But there's, since we've started this podcast, so many other playoff games that year have been put on our radar as highly suspicious, where people thought, you know, the games were amiss. We interviewed George Karl, and Karl referenced the 1993 Western Conference Finals, Game 7. The Suns shot 64 free throws in that game. Karl said it took everything in his power and all of his assistant coaches not to get kicked out in the first quarter. And there's all these games where it seems like somebody wanted a certain team to win. And that's what the second part of our investigation is about. Just, is there any truth there? Is it just referees had a bad game, or is there something more suspicious at play? And that's what we dive into in the second half of the podcast. But to answer your question, I think the NBA is in a good place now. And for those of us who love basketball, it's nice to see, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, look, it's interesting. You're like, on one hand, the NBA is in a good place. The other hand, tonight we have a game 7, and Scott Foster, I think, is going to be one of the refs, right? And you're,
I think so.
Yes. So it's a, bizarre place to be. I guess here's the most important question. If it's on the up and up now, do you believe it was on the up and up then in terms of the ultimate outcome of the most important NBA games?
Oh, that's a good question. After this investigation, so we released episode 4 on Thursday, so I can't say as much as I can say in 6 weeks. But after this investigation, after devoting eight years of my life to answering that question, the answer is no. I don't think that those games were played with the integrity that we expect in the NBA and in a thing that we care a lot about. I don't think those games, I think all those games, I think there's a lot of games in here. It's not every game. It's not every championship. There's not an asterisk by every championship. But if you look at certain games, which we're going to examine in the podcast, and you look at the system, I think we as basketball fans have a lot of questions that need to be answered by the NBA.
Last thing, the question you mentioned, you grew up as a Jewish basketball player in Southern California. Are you a Jordan guy or a LeBron guy?
Oh God, that is tough. I'm actually a LeBron guy. And that's probably, you know, I'm 34. So Jordan's peak, I was young. I don't remember his greatness. Watching The Last Dance was for me, I'm like the exact target audience, because Jordan peaked right before I could really understand how incredible he was. But so maybe I'm going back. Maybe I am a Jordan guy. That's why this question is so hard. But I've been, you know, as that debate has raged on, I've been a LeBron guy, just because, I don't know, I've watched his greatness in person, and it's so extraordinary. But I hope your audience doesn't like not listen to the Whistleblower podcast because of that. It's such a divisive argument.
Is the Whistleblower podcast only examining basketball?
Yes. Franzese, you know, I mentioned earlier, like, we interviewed Franzese for those that don't know, former Columbo capo in the Columbo crime family, was featured in Netflix's Fear City. He's probably, you know, one of the most open and outspoken mobsters he was brilliant. He was called the Yuppie Don. He was concocting schemes for the mob that were making tens of millions of dollars a week. He's probably, you know, in my research in the mob, which is not as thorough as it is in the NBA refereeing, he might be the most brilliant mobster of all time. And so Franzese says he has two NBA referees on his payroll. He had two NBA referees on his payroll that weren't Tim Donaghy. He also says that his game-fixing operation spread to football, college basketball, baseball, and tennis. Tennis is the easiest sport to fix. That's a different conversation for a different day. You just need one guy. There's a lot of ways to fix a tennis match. But in basketball, he had referees on his payroll, and he just describes it as easy. You know, the point spread's 5. It's not, you know, you're not, like, fixing a basketball game in relation to the spread or the over-under, it was easy. They just called a lot of fouls, right, one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's definitely something we have to examine in all sports. I think basketball and tennis are the easiest sports to fix. But over the years, there's definitely been game fixing in pretty much every sport at varying levels. I can't imagine – any sport that hasn't been fixed in some capacity in the past 30 years.
Were there any players that were involved in any of these schemes for basketball?
So Franzese says he did have players and NBA personnel. I pressed him on that. He didn't really, you know, he wasn't going to give names, but he said he had players and personnel, but that referees were his preferred mechanism for game fixing because they had so much control. You know, if a player, is bombing, the coach can take him out, right? So he says he did have players, basketball players, in that era in the 80s and 90s who he was working with. And again, I don't know, you know, he didn't name names, but he was a New York-based guy, and a lot of his operation took place in that region. That doesn't mean anything. It could have been somebody for the San Antonio Spurs or Clippers or whoever. But he says he did have players. For the most part, though, that's all we have on the players' front is that allegation from Franzese. I don't have really any other, you know, obviously there's the Boston College scandal and a handful of others.
Northwestern, but, yeah, when I was a kid. Northwestern,
yep, yeah. Yeah, but that's
– Arizona State.
I think, yep, and so I think it's on the college level, you know, if it was Hofstra versus Northeastern, and, I think those are probably – those games were – if you can get a player – Hofstra star player, you're probably in good shape. But for the most part, his scheme revolved around referees.
Can't wait to hear it. Listen, in the meantime, great work. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
And we'll promote it. And I appreciate you being my guest. And the shout-out was really nice. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Doug.
All right, thanks, Tim. That was really interesting. All right, from Tim Livingston, a very colorful former head coach in college basketball is a dear friend of my brother who you've heard on this podcast and a close friend of mine. His name is Marvin Menzie. Marvelous to anybody in the West Coast or anybody who's ever been alongside him. Just has a great way about him. Wait till you hear his personal story as he joined me to tell us what life was like, how he became a coach after being just some regular student at UCLA. So Marvelous, let's start. You go to college where? You went to where to graduate? You graduated UCLA, didn't you?
Yeah, graduated UCLA, went to Hamilton High School. LA guy.
I'm aware you're an LA guy. So what did you were you a manager at UCLA? Like what was your UCLA student life like?
I coached Special Olympics at UCLA. That was my first experience in coaching.
That's awesome.
I had no athletic ability at all. Unlike you and your brother, I didn't have a chance to play college ball. I loved it. I played midnight league, but I just couldn't manage the big time like you guys. UCLA was awesome. Enjoyed the whole journey there. Was, you know, joined a fraternity, Phi Beta Sigma fraternity, and got fully acclimated into a bunch of the stuff that a lot of times the, you know, typical student athletes don't get a chance to enjoy. And I got the most out of that.
Yeah, no question. Okay, so you get done with school. What's your plan?
All right, good question. I come out of there, and you got to think back now. I got to think back further than you. So I'm 58 now, so I'm thinking back. Let's see. All right, I want to own my own business. I want to make a bunch of money like most people coming out of college, but didn't have a specific plan other than I knew I wanted to do my own thing. I worked in a completion bond company in Beverly Hills for a fireman insurance fund, and I did that for about 4 months and realized I never wanted to sit behind a desk for the rest of my life. So I just started dabbling in different things. Owned a bakery. I don't know if you knew that. I had the Marvelous Fudge and Brownie Company in South Central LA. We had that for about 4 years before we sold it. So we did that. We actually started out in Westwood, right down the street from UCLA, but wasn't able
wait,
to.
Wait, you owned a bakery. How do you come to own a bakery?
Well, I worked at Famous Amos when I was in high school.
Okay.
Remember the one on Sunset, like the original Famous Amos? Okay?
I can nod and pretend like I know what you're talking about, but I'm a white kid from Orange County. Like, we used to come and play basketball games in South Central at Challengers Boys Club on the weekend, okay? And then everything moved to, like, Dominguez High School and Compton College, and Victoria Park was where we played Slam and Jam. But that's like Carson. That's not even in L.A. So I can nod and say, oh, yeah, I know Famous Amos. Yeah, but I have no idea what you're talking about. Still,
okay,
I thought
for sure you were would be knowledgeable of Famous Amos cookies.
I know what. No, wait. There's a difference now. Do I know what Famous Amos cookies is? Of course I know what Famous Amos cookies is. Amos on Sunset? Right. You know the Famous Amos? Oh, yeah, I know that place. That's the spot. I have no idea what you're talking about there.
Okay, good point. Point taken. All right. You nailed it.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me give you a little more background on
yes.
This. So I'm hustling to make a buck, you know, and so I'm in high school. I'm catching the number 7 bus to Sunset and just off of Sunset La Brea. And I'm working over there like we're just grinding in the bakery, burning up. And I'm seeing all this money come through this little tiny cookie shop that Famous Amos owned. And so I said, you know what, man, this guy's killing it. And we had a blast. It was a great family atmosphere. So I graduated from UCLA. I'm like, well, what do I know? What am I good at? Well, I know how to make cookies. So I hit up a bunch of my family members and friends, put a business plan together, went out and raised a pretty good amount of money and actually – almost got it opened in West L.A., in Westwood, actually, right off of Wayburn there. Almost got it open for commercial, but then we got slammed on the last certification, whatever it was. So I moved it into wholesale, moved into South Central, and had a blast doing it for several years while I was coaching. This whole time, I'm kind of – that was my way of giving back, you know. I didn't have a lot of money for tithing at the church, so I decided to be a service guy, and that was kind of my beginning of my coaching career, was just kind of giving back to my old high school and coaching Special Olympics at UCLA in the summer.
Okay, so how did you start coaching? Well, like at Santa Monica City, was that your first coaching gig? Like, what was your first coaching gig out of college?
It was actually at Hamilton. I did play, football and ran track and field and so forth, cross country, stuff like that. But so my former coach, who was also my junior high school teacher, moved up from Lewis Pasture Junior High, which is now Laces, and he asked me to come help him out because they just didn't have enough coaches, volunteer coaches. So I said, sure, yeah, I'll coach some basketball. I love it, you know. So I started studying it a little bit. I was doing some AAU stuff, and I said, you know what, it's pretty fun. And it kind of trickled into an opportunity with John McMullen, as you referenced, at Santa Monica College. He saw me bringing over the guys every year to summer league from Hamilton to Santa Monica and said, hey, this guy would be a good assistant. I can get you a few bucks, probably more than what you're making, which was absolutely true because I was making nothing. And then the Santa Monica journey started, which was awesome. We went like 8 years there, had a great time, found out that was my passion over making cookies and running nightclubs. I think I don't know if I ever told you my nightclub story.
I was getting to that. That one I knew. We'll get to that in a second, but keep going.
Okay. Well, so then I go from Santa Monica College. I get an opportunity I'll just give you the quick resume bounce from there. I go to Santa Monica to Sacramento State
with Don Newman. Sure.
I go back to Santa Monica for a year, and then it's just incredible fortune of working with Coach Fisher in his inaugural year at San Diego State. We do that for 4 years. I go to SC with Henry Bibby. Then I go to Lon Kruger at UNLV. Then I go to Rick Pitino at Louisville to New Mexico State, New Mexico State back to UNLV.
Okay, wait. You're coaching in junior college as an assistant, and you ran a nightclub?
Yes. That's just like it sounds, too. It's pretty entertaining. So I'm at this time, I think we're in like early 90s, and I'm just, trying to figure out a way to make a buck. I'm making a little bit at Santa Monica, but not enough to live where I want to live and so on and so forth. So I ended up joining some friends. One of my frat brothers asked me to help him out because he knew I knew everybody, and we started an organization called the Highland Jazz Society, and it was a great concept. We had comedy and jazz from like 8 to 11, and then we would just go into dancing. We'd actually literally move the chairs and tables out of the way and dance right there where people were eating earlier. It was an old school like dinner show and dance. I mean, we had it rolling, Doug. I mean, we had big time celebrities coming through. We had big time entertainment. We made a really good run. I think we did it for maybe 10, 11 years. And I mean, Wesley Snipes. I turned away Tupac at the door. Tupac comes to the door. He's got some of his boys with him, but we had a strict dress code, you know? So
yeah.
I said, man, I know who you are. I said, but he was just kind of up and coming, obviously. So I said, but you know, I can't let you in with you guys dressed like that. I said, if you guys want to come back, you know, dressed appropriately, I'll let everybody in free. And he did. They came back. They had a great time. But Shaq, Kobe, Lakers, Rams, Eric Dickerson, all those guys used to frequent the spot. So I wish I would have utilized connection. I wish I knew about relationships and connections and networking back then. Like, but I was just trying to get that $20 at the door. That was it. That was my goal. I had to pay rent.
Okay, so during this time, you know, you're making a good amount of money, a little bit of money. You're coaching
yep.
Santa Monica. You had players like stay with you, right? Like that's the California junior college thing is you got to find an assistant coach or somebody that'll take in some of these kids because you don't have dorms, you don't have apartments, you don't have money. You had like what?
Oh, yeah.
You'd have Kenny Bruner stay with you, didn't he?
Yeah, Kenny Bruner, Gumby, James Gray, another, L.A. legend. I had Sidney Faison.
I play with Sidney Faison. He played with our team like 6th through maybe 8th or 9th grade, right? Went on to play in the NFL. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sidney, we had all those guys live with me. I had a 2-bedroom apartment And I had the one room, and they had a. We made the living room a room, and we made the other bedroom. You know, put two beds in there. And so I always kept four guys that were the ones that might need me the most on the team. They would always have that option to stay with.
Now
so,
you are a sneaky amazing chef. Where does that come from?
I have no idea. I guess my parents, you know, my mom and dad, more so my dad probably, you know, both my parents are from West Indies from Guyana. And so I used to watch my dad cook all the time, crab curry and lobster tacos and all this, you know, exotic, crazy, really tasty, cool meals. And I just kind of got into it, you know, watching him. And we ate very, 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 very well growing up. And so I just adopted that passion he had for cooking.
What's the best meal you made?
Probably my gumbo. My wife, Tammy, you know, is from her family. Her roots are from New Orleans, and I just loved the meal, so I just really wanted to figure out how to make it really, really well. And so I practiced and screwed up a bunch of pots, but I finally figured it out. Entered a cooking contest in when I was living in Palms, working at Santa Monica College. Took third behind two New Orleans grandmas, so I wasn't too hurt for taking third. But I got a $50 gift certificate, so that was cool.
When you were at Santa Monica City, in addition to, you know, Sidney Faison playing in the NFL, and Kenny Bruner and Gumby and all these dudes coming through, the football team, I'm close with TJ Houshmandzadeh. Hoosh was there, and Chad Johnson was there too, right?
Yeah, Chad tried out for the – he wanted to keep – He asked me both years of his age, begging me to get on the team. And I was like, Chad, you're going to play in the NFL. Like, Coach Taylor would kill me if I let you play on the basketball team. He was a great personality. He's just like he was in the NFL is who he was in college. He just had the big smile and great confidence. And he's a really, really good dude. You know, I enjoyed being around him in the junior college days.
Okay, so when you interviewed with Steve Fisher, what did you do to stand out?
You know, it was going to be tough, right? Even my current boss at the time, John McMullen, said, you know, Marvin, I don't want to bust your bubble, but this is Steve Fisher. He's a national championship, you know, coach, and you don't know him at all, and you don't have a lot of connections to him. It's going to be tough for you to get that gig. So Coach kind of motivated me to be different. So it's funny you ask that, because I said, all right, what am I going to do creatively to just get him to look at me a little bit more? Because I knew I could do a good job for him. It was just a matter of convincing him. So I remember one time I knew he was coming down to school. He was recruiting Marcus Mason at the time, who ended up going to Xavier. But Marcus was he was coming to see Marcus. So I went over to a restaurant across the street on Pico, I forget the name of it now, and I said, listen, hopefully I'm gonna bring this guy Coach Fisher in. And the bartender was like, oh my gosh, Steve Fisher, man, yeah, bring him through. And I'm like, all right, well, here's the deal. I gave him my credit card, and I said, I need you guys to not charge me. You could charge it on the card later, I said, but I want you to pretend like I am your guy, you know, I'm just doing this great job over at Santa Monica, at the college cross street. So, and these guys are all actors at these restaurants anyway, right? So he told the staff and so forth. So Coach Fisher comes over, and he's about to get on the road. I said, hey, Coach, you know, traffic's horrible right now back on that 405. I said, you want to stop and get a bite to eat? And on the chance that he was going to say yes, I already had it all laid out, Doug. So we go across the street, and it's like clockwork. We walk in, they're like, it's Cheers, you know, hey, Mark. And so we go, we sit, we have this great meal. They come over to, I said, can I get the check? They, oh, Coach, you know, your money's no good here.
Oh, that's the best.
It was awesome, man. So Coach Fish is looking like, who is this guy? Who is this dude? You know, and that was one of the things I did. There are several little other tricky things, you know, people normally send FedExes and top 10 reasons to hire this guy and so forth. Well, I have cartoonists draw up my stuff, professional artists, and buddies of mine. So I just tried to really stand out from the other candidates he was looking at.
So you get the job there. I would say You know, the biggest name player you signed was Evan Burns. Okay, so, but Evan was, what, committed to going to UCLA, but, well, that was during a time when UCLA, you had to pass calculus in high school. Is that how you guys
got,
and so then he, what, decommitted, and then you guys got, like, how did that work that you landed Evan?
Well, we, I was recruiting him like crazy, and everybody was like, I was, you know, I'm a first year or second year Division I coach, just fresh out of junior college, you know, and everybody's like, Marvin, you're not getting a McDonald's All-American. You're not getting Evan Burns to go to San Diego State. So kind of like, you know, slow your roll. And I didn't care. I was just like, well, that would be great if I could get that kid. So I just was a pit bull, man, and I've worked, you know, the dynamics of the family. I knew his uncles. They had went to Hamilton, and I had just developed a great relationship with his mom and his stepdad, Bob, and his mom, Shelly, who's passed by now, got – rest her soul, but we just developed a great friendship and relationship. So he actually went to UCLA and was enrolled in summer school there, where he was about to start summer school. He was on campus when he got the word that he wasn't accepted. Well, all right, plan B, we got to move fast, right? Well, who's next up that I'm most comfortable with? Marvin Menzies at San Diego State. and then the rest was history. He came over, we got him in the summer, he ended up having a great freshman year. I think it was newcomer of the year or something, and then went on to play a little bit after college.
What was your experience like to be – now you're back at USC, right? So you got your four years – you're back at USC. Henry Bibby was there. You guys had dudes, but what was that like for – you mentioned L.A. guy, you know?
Right.
You'd come up through the junior college ranks. You guys started killing it at San Diego State because I played against that first team that was dog shit. I mean, we're I don't know if my brother told you that story, but we're playing you guys in Oklahoma City, and we're up 40-14 at the half. And coach, like plain as day, like right in front of the team at halftime, he turns to me, and goes, "You tell your brother, you got to get some players. They're gonna get your ass fired, right?" Like it was, and you know, 4 years later, you got the best team in the league. You got some transfers, some dudes from LA that people missed on. You got Evan Burns coming. Okay, so then you go to USC. What was that like for you to be back in LA?
It was great. I was actually living in Azusa because I couldn't afford to live in L.A.
Don't they do interest-free loans at SC? Wasn't that or was it not?
Yeah. Not in my tenure. No. but it was good. I mean, it was home. You know, so I could just bop over to my mom's house anytime, and it was all my brothers are still there, so it was good to have family around, coming to games and so forth. But Henry Bibby is, I mean, he's a really good dude. He's kind of got a reputation of being a little standoffish, or not standoffish, but just kind of an NBA, you know, guy where you don't really, you can reach out to him and he'll say all the right things, but he's not going to ingratiate you at all. And it's not true. The dude is such a good dude, man. Like he was really supportive of all the coaches. If he had a really late practice, he'd say, "Hey, you guys, I'll cover it," and so you guys, you know, can be with your families. And he was really, really good. Of all the guys I worked for, he might have been one of the best at in-game management, like during the course of the game, just being able to identify something and tweak it. I mean, he would put a play in that we never even worked on. I don't know if that was for good or for bad, but it was very ingenuitive, and we would get good looks. We just didn't have guys that can make shots outside of maybe Desmond Farmer, but that was about it. But it was a great experience working for him because I really got to know him, and he was a good dude.
Okay, so what led you to go and work for Lon Kruger at UNLV?
Honestly, USC was on the chopping block, and it looked like they weren't going to survive. And I got a call of interest to go to UNLV, but I didn't want to just leave Henry because he gave me an opportunity. So I go into his office and said, "Coach, if I can just get one more year on my contract, that's guaranteed. So if they do let you go, at least I know I'll be good." But they weren't willing to do that. So I just did what was best for my family and took the job with Coach Kruger over at UNLV. That was his first year as well. We got him some guys. Actually, I was only there for a year, but when we left, they went to the Sweet 16 with the guys that we recruited. So
Wink,
I felt good about
Wink, was Wink your guy? Who got him, Wink?
No, Wink was Lou Hill. Lou Hill got Wink. We obviously team recruited him, but he was the point. He was the point on Wink. He had the biggest.
Well, hold on. So they went to the tournament. His son came over from Arizona State. His grad transfer. Wink was there. Those are the. So who got Lou Amundson? Was that you?
Yeah, well, he was. No, Lou was
No. So look, these are all the. Wendell White's a good player, but all the. I just named the three best dudes. You didn't get them, Marv.
No, you're taking
credit.
What about Joel?
Oh, Joel Anthony?
Joel Anthony?
Yeah, he played a little bit in the NBA for the Miami Heat.
He wasn't bad. He's got an NBA championship. He wasn't bad. Do you remember the big? They had a big kid from Africa, and I'm drawing a blank on his name. They won the championship at Compton College for Damon Powell. Holy smokes! Why am I forgetting his name? It'll come to me. But he was he started for him too. So I had three starters, and Joe Darger I recruited there as well.
Yeah,
and Joe Darger I spoke with yesterday. He actually lives here in Phoenix. We're supposed to get together next week. He does flooring and stuff now, so he's going to do my floor for me. So now Joe, that's a perfect example, Doug, of why I got into coaching. I never even coached Joe. I recruited him there, and we're still friends to this day because it's. At the end of the day, man, that's why I got into this whole thing, was to kind of give back and teach and give life lessons, and kind of that was it. And I just thought about that as you said that. I didn't even coach Joe, but he helped them win. But it's not even about that. It was about the relationships, man. And listen, here's my 100-year theory, okay?
Okay.
In 100 years, we're all dead. What did you do? What was your? Were you a drop in the ocean, or were you a tidal wave or a ripple because of all the people that you touched, and then they went in touch because of what you taught them? So I'm trying to be a tidal wave in 100 years. That's my theory. That's my theory, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, wait. So you go? Did you a home visit with Joe Darger? Right here, you are, marvelous Marvin Menzie from Los Angeles, right? Who had a nightclub, a bakery. Coach of JUCO, you know, taking anybody. Joe Darger, I believe, if I remember, like seven siblings. There's like eight kids, right?
Great memory. Exactly right.
From Utah. So I'm getting like Mormon. Eight. So what do you remember? What was that home visit like?
All right. So so we were talking about this, ironically, just a few days ago when I was talking to Joe. So we go into the house. There's... I'm not kidding you. We're at a dinner table. It's like 12 people sitting at this dinner table, okay, because the coach from UNLV is there. So we go in, and I'm telling stories, and they're laughing, and we're having a blast. And he's got a nephew that he said, hey, coach, you got to see this. I said, see what? So his nephew's like maybe four or five years old. And I want you to picture like an arc in a house that's just like a walkway, you know, and there's that arc there, right? So the kid, I can't remember his name, but he grabs the wall and starts to climb up, like he's the strongest little kid I've ever met in my life. He climbs up the wall through the top of the ceiling, and he's like 10 feet up in the air, upside down, continues to climb, and goes up and comes down on the other side. I've never seen anything like it. It was like a Cirque du Soleil, you know, show in the middle of dinner. And so Joe says, actually, he lives here now. He lives in Phoenix. So I can't wait to see him again. He's probably doesn't look anything like he did then, but he's probably still as strong. So home visits, top five all time, just as far as connection and chemistry. And I was just myself, and they were just a great family, and it was just a good fit for him to go. And he had a good career there.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, outside of Utah, Vegas is like the second – most populated area with Mormons. It's crazy.
Yeah, no doubt.
Okay, so then you go work for Rick Pitino. Now, Lon Kruger, by all estimations, is like all-time greatest guys, super classy, loves to play golf, but, you know, just a complete gentleman. Now, that's not to take any shot at Rick Pitino, but Pitino is again, this is based upon reputation, especially then, a very, very demanding boss to work for. He made you work out. You had to work out with the team or with a trainer. What was the workout schedule?
He told me when I got hired, okay, you're going to, cause I needed to lose some weight. So he said, all right, well, you're going to lose the weight. You're going to work out with this, in the mornings early. If you don't make weight, on Fridays, then, you know, you can't go out and recruit. And he said it very calm and just, And I'm thinking to myself, okay, what do you mean make weight? Well, we'll have an established weight that you have to have every week, and if you don't make it, then you can't go out on the road. And we'll help you continue to it, because you'll just have to get up earlier and just start working out with the strength and conditioning coach, and we'll be a little bit more hands-on with it. And I'm kind of chuckling in the interview, and I'm going, is he serious? And he wasn't playing. I lost 50 pounds when I was with him. I got down to 180, I think it was 185.
Damn!
Yeah, it was no joke. I didn't think I could lose 50 pounds. But, hey, he's a great motivator, let's put it like that. intense, detail-oriented, great at skill development, one of the best I've ever worked for. I learned a lot from him, obviously. He takes a lot of pride in mentoring his coaches. Probably the most loyal guy you want to meet in the business when it comes to looking after his family, his guys. I mean, if I was involved with any job, you know, Coach P didn't hesitate to want to call and to even get me involved with a job. Where most guys are kind of like, well, you know, if you get in, you know, I'll call. Some guys are like that. You know, he wasn't. He was like, you know, we talk all the time still, and he was amazing.
No, I have said he is the greatest modern day basketball mind. I mean, what people forget is when he was with the Celtics, they tanked before it was popular tank. They had two lottery picks. They just missed on Tim Duncan. When he was with the Knicks, that was the first NBA team to really embrace the three-point shot. And he obviously used that when he was at Providence. They went to the Final Four. His mixture of pressure and into zones, and then he changed and morphed his offense when he's at Kentucky and then at Louisville. He's just an amazing basketball mind and basketball coach, and it really is a shame because of, you know, how it ended at Louisville. I think cast a shadow over what was really remarkable run to a national championship, and what really happened, what that program was really like when you were there.
Oh, you know, so when I got calls on this from all kind of media when everything was jumping off, I was at UNLV when he was going under that firestorm there. And I just used to tell everyone the same thing, which was, that wouldn't have happened while we were there. I just cannot see, like, he is so different. I shouldn't say he's so different. He is detailed.
I'll give you an example, but it's not the same, though, now. Like, I had a coach, I'll leave his name out of it, who told me in his next, before this stuff went down, he was like, hey, something really weird happened. We played Louisville. I go, what do you mean weird? He's like, we played him at their place. When I showered and we went out to our bus, his car was already gone. Whereas in the past, it'd be like he and I had heard, like, at the end, and this is one of the reasons it went bad, was at the end, he spent so much time in Miami and so much time in New York, and he had just kind of grown past the everyday thing and allowed others to take care of the little things, and that's where it went astray. That's what I was told, that a guy who...
Okay, I'll address that, because I could tell you this. I stayed close to the program after I was gone, and I knew a bunch of the assistants and was close with them, obviously. And not obviously, but was close with them, helped coach and assessing who to hire in a couple of the spots. Kevin Keats, you know, and I were buddies from when he was a prep school coach and so forth. But then Andre played for him, obviously. So here's the deal. I think coach, and I don't know, you say his car may be gone. Okay, what was he doing? Who did he have an appointment? Who knows? You know, I mean, he can't judge anything off his car not being there. I mean, the bottom line was the man cared about his players. He cared about his staff. He was definitely in touch with the accountability portion. How it happened and how it unfolded, I wasn't there. I can't tell you, obviously, but I can't for a minute believe that he knew what was going on. And now, is that his fault? Okay, well, he's already said that, yes, okay, I should have done a better job maybe this monitoring the assistants or something like that. But I cannot believe for a minute that he knew. It's the man I work for he would have fired me in a New York minute had he known that I was putting on having strippers over at Minardi Hall, which is his guy's place. I mean, there's no way. I still to this day, I'm kind of like, Yeah, not coach. Yeah, yeah. No, no, that's not to say that things don't happen. And, you know, he could have maybe done some things differently. He'll probably admit that. But I just don't believe he knew about it.
How did you get the New Mexico State job?
Coach Pitino. Basically, Reggie was there. Reggie worked for Coach and took over New Mexico State. Did a really good job and was there for, I think, a couple years. And they went to the NCAA tournament, lost to Texas. And Reggie had the promotion with the Maloos. He knew those guys from the NBA. Got a chance to go work with the Sacramento Kings. Opened up New Mexico State. And obviously, he did a good job. And McKinley Boston was the athletic director there and had a great relationship with Coach Pitino. So it was just a natural. It was like, all right, give me another one of your guys.
Yeah. So, who's next?
He had that kind of juice, you know. He did.
So you get there. Pascal Siakam, what was his recruitment like?
You know, it's interesting. I have extensive relationships internationally, both Europe, Africa, some in the Caribbean, and I went over and saw this kid in Africa and had some guys that told me about him and so forth. And when he came to the U.S., he was underneath the radar because he was very, very raw. College coaches go out, they see African kids in high school, if they're juniors or seniors, and they're not polished, then they usually move on because they stereotype them. They think they're, you know, well, he's not, you can't catch, they got bad hands, or they got this, or they got that. Well, the thing about Pascal, as I noticed his progression, he just kept getting better. Like, every time I go see him, every time an assistant would go see him, his improvement was remarkable. And then it just catapulted when he was actually with us, and we recruited him there, and he came and then when his father passed, his motivation moved to a whole nother level. And it was already in an upper echelon, but I've never seen we used to have to try to kick him out of the gym so he could get rest. It was, you don't come across guys like that often, and that's why he is where he is today. But the recruitment process itself was pretty straightforward in the sense that just guys who I think he could have played at a much higher level, but he developed underneath this too, and he got playing time, and he continued to get better and better and better because he was on the floor. Had he gone too high of a level, might not have worked out. So it was a perfect fit, perfect timing, and really, really happy for him.
What were those big guys that you had? You had just gigantic dudes.
The Boulard brothers, baby. The Boulard brothers. 7'5" and 7'3". From India originally, their heritage is from India. Their parents are from India, and they were born in Canada, I believe. But Sim and Tanvir, and you know, we recruited guys like that by design because our conference, the WAC, was very, didn't have size, you know. But the big boys had size, right? Anytime you got to a playoff situation or tournament, you were going to go against somebody that had a footer, 6'11", athletic dude. And so we really concentrated on doing a good job developing and recruiting big players. So we had Chalizi Napawe, and we had Sim and Tanvir, and Pascal was only 6'9", but we had a bunch of 6'10", 6'11" dudes in my tenure that, you know, helped us to have a lot of success there.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you have these guys from all over the world. What's that like to coach?
Right.
What's that like to coach?
You know, I enjoy it because it adds another dynamic to the locker room where the U.S. kids are, I'm getting myself in a sling here, but U.S. kids are wired and raised in a culture that's much different than other cultures.
They're selfish. They're selfish. They're entitled. No. Listen.
Hey, I'm taking the year off. I can tell the truth. Okay, yeah. They're just, it's everything's changed. You remember when, and maybe you remember this, you remember when there was the only thing on TV for sports was ABC Wild World of Sports, and the guy was crashing off on Sunday nights, crashing off the hill skiing? That That was the beginning of the show. You might have missed that. You
yeah, no, no, no. I remember the agony of defeat, right? Yeah, no question.
That was it. But that was it. Think about it, Doug. There were no podcasts. There was no ESPN. There was no Fox Sports and all of that stuff. That was it. We had one show for sports on Sunday night. Track and field was huge, and Olympic sports were huge, and it was a different time, you know, and team and unity and national pride were awesome. And then the internet came, and then, you know, all of these media outlets and self-promotional type deals. I mean, even now today in the NBA, they say LeBron versus this guy, or, you know, what they don't say, like the good old days of Boston Lakers is, maybe it'll come back one day, but it's gone. Those days are not in existence. And it trickled down to the youth. The youth were, you know, becoming my minutes, my exposure, my opportunity to play at the highest level. And just everything that comes with the scouting and the AAU programs, and who, you know, kids bouncing around from AAU program to AAU program because of playing time. And it's just a really selfish, me generation. And so to get back to the original question, there's a lot of kids that didn't grow up in that environment that were humble, hardworking, appreciative, that brought a different dynamic to the locker room. And I thought that was one of the reasons that I could get, if I can get these guys in the same pot, this big melting pot together, that the gumbo would come out tasting sweet. And we had some great relationships that were developed, some great teammates that were developed, and a lot of life lessons were learned as a result of me having a variety of cultures to educate.
You had a ton of success there. And then UNLV had hired Chris Beard, and he changed his mind. He goes to Texas Tech. It's one of those jobs that I know how you're thinking at the time. Like, it's UNLV. Like, I can
gotta take this.
Yeah, you gotta take it.
Right.
But I also know a lot about what was going on behind the scenes. You know, should you have turned it down? Like, what in hindsight? Take me through your thoughts on UNLV.
Well, in hindsight, if I could go back in anything, I'd probably be a multi-billionaire right now, right?
Yeah.
But
you have to. Everybody has to learn from the success.
Correct.
And learn from the mistakes. So to
correct.
Say, like, I don't think in hindsight, like, I feel like people who say that's bullshit. It doesn't mean that you
right.
have to live in the past, but you do have to learn from the past.
Absolutely, and I learned a great deal there. I have no regrets for taking that job. I have. I'm 100% a Rebel fan. I hope that TJ does a great job and continues to win. He probably have three of my kids starting probably next year. I think Bryce will probably start. Marvin's got a chance to start, and Mbake Jong probably got a chance to start. So I'll be watching those guys and pulling for them every step of the way. You know, it was a challenging situation, and I got a little bit of an ego. I thought I could get in there, and it didn't matter who was the president or who was AD. You know, they were gonna keep me around because I was doing so well. We just didn't win enough for their liking, and I don't hold that against Desiree at all. I think she's, you know, a great up and coming athletic director who had to make a tough decision. I think we had a great relationship, and we're still, you know, we still text every once in a blue moon, and, you know, it was a journey, man. It was a chapter, and I tried to get the most out of it going forward. Like you said, you try to learn from the past, and I don't think I'd do much differently, to be honest with you. There was a different philosophical approach when my first year, in terms of we wanted consistency, we want to grow the program, and then that AD gets let go, and
right.
the president decides to leave. So now I got a new regime who's like, we need to win. And so I'm like, oh, okay, wait, hold on. But, you know, at the end of the day, I understood, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, that ain't that. Come on, dude. You didn't get no. I mean, who gets that little time?
Well, you know what? I got, I mean, technically it was three, but it was really two because of the first situation. I mean, the first year, but it is what it is. I mean, what are you going to do?
Nothing. I mean, you should have got a longer contract, more guaranteed at the back end. I don't know. So, okay. So
there should also be more black head coaches, and there should also be this, and there should also be, but
okay, so let me ask
those are all things that you gotta work through, like you said, you know, and you gotta learn from. You gotta try to grow from.
Okay, so let's discuss. We got about like 5 minutes left. Let's discuss the black head coach thing, okay?
Because
it's interesting. Like, I view the Pac-12 as, I mean, like, look, those schools are as open to hiring whomever as any. They have no black head coaches. On the other hand, if I was being fair, I would say Henry Bibby and George Raveling have been the head coach at USC. Don Newman was the interim coach, and then they've had a couple black head coaches at Arizona State, right?
Right.
UCLA had Larry Farmer, Walt Hazard. So it's not like they have it. Cal's two previous head coaches to Mark Fox were both with Conzo Martin and who was the other one? Who was like only lasted like 2 years? They're both young. He was a young guy. Louisville guy. What's his name?
That was at.
No, it was at Cal. Who was the head coach before?
Joaquin Jones,
right? Another LA guy, but also a Louisville guy. Romar was the head coach at UW forever before he got fired. The last coach at Oregon and Washington State was the same guy, Ernie Kent, again, African-American coach. Okay, so,
right.
But why do you believe the overall number of black head coaches is so low right now when it's a sport that has given black head coaches opportunities in the past? Why are the numbers down instead of up?
Well, first of all, I don't think you can look at any – you have to look at every coach on his own merit and see what he could bring to the table. I don't think enough black coaches are getting a legitimate look. So it comes back down to how many are really being considered in the interview process as compared to, well, we better interview a black coach, you know, for perception, token interview, so to speak. But I think that's changing. I think the social injustice is opening eyes across the country to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, maybe we need to operate a little bit differently and give at least and the opportunity. I'm not saying they should hire a coach because he's black, right? I'm saying they should hire a guy that they think is capable of doing the job. And if he happens to be black, that would be great. But they're not going to know if they're not legitimately getting looked at. I mean, you got guys that, there are so many really good coaches that are out there even now that have great career winning percentages, you know, that aren't really getting legitimately considered because of, I mean, how many times here's the other thing, Doug, and we only got 5 minutes, so I'll probably have to call you at another time and get into this deeper because I don't want to just touch it and not really, you know, get my message across the right way with examples and stuff like that. But I will just tell you this. I think that it is more guys got to be considered. More African-American coaches need to be considered. Black coaches, whatever you want to call them, need to be considered for those types of jobs. And I just don't think that has happened.
Give me your best Santa Monica City story.
Santa Monica City story. Let me see. Oh God, man, there's several. I probably Jamie Foxx. I'm running the nightclub. I'm at Santa Monica College, but I'm running the nightclub. I go over, and my buddy tells me, "Hey, man, you got to see this guy. He's going to be amazing." So a couple of my older players come with me, and we go and we watch Jamie Foxx for about 2 hours, perform on the piano, do comedy, sing, imitations, and we were in tears amazed for like an hour and 45 or so. And I'm going, who is this dude? And then, you know, history takes off after that. But I remember sitting there with my guys going, this is amazing. It's not a basketball story, but it was like, wow. I am watching the next Richard Pryor. I'm watching the next, you know, whoever, like right now. And I knew it. I knew it, but he wasn't popular. He paid $10 to get in.
last thing, you're 58. You got a beautiful wife, kids, family, house in Phoenix. You're collecting a crazy check from Grand Canyon, right? You think things are good for Marvelous. You've done a lot of things.
Life is good.
Will you be a head coach again?
You know, that's a great question. I would go to the right situation at 58, but I wouldn't. I'm not chasing it to just get back in. I have a desire to. I still have a lot left to give, obviously, a lot left to share and teach. But I have to be somewhere where, you know, I would be wanted and pursued a little bit, probably. and it's good alignment. And you know, they got a chance to win their conference. They've got a stable president, athletic director, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of dynamics to go on whether I would get back in. I will say this: Brian Buehler, who's the president at Grand Canyon University, has been awesome to me and has given me great opportunities to dabble in some other things right now that are very intriguing to me that I'm doing internationally, and I'm in a position as his assistant and kind of a special assistant to him, working with some projects that I have experience and relationships with, and that's really fun. So I'm enjoying the COVID year off, but only God knows where the Marvelous one will be in a year from now.
All right, we're going to call you back. We're going to have a conversation. We'll have a couple other guests on with us, and we'll discuss the paucity of black head coaches in Division I basketball. In the meantime, Marvelous, thanks for sharing your story. Great catching up with you, and we'll talk soon.
You got it, brother. Take care, man.
All right, thanks, Marvin. And listen, if you like interviews like this, check out the Doug Gottlieb Show, daily 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you download podcasts. You can download the hourly or daily version of the show. In the meantime, next week we'll get more on the NBA, more on the Western Eastern Conference Finals, and the college basketball bubbles, which are starting to form. We'll make sure they don't pop. In the meantime, thank you so much for downloading. Don't forget to subscribe and to rate. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.